Welcome to the Label Podcast, a show about disability, illness, and difference. I'm Lucy.
And I'm Alice.
And that's Lola. Lives differently, kaleidoscope identity, and this is who I'm meant to be. I'm just labeled me. I'm just labeled me.
Don't forget, in this episode, I might swear, Lucy might cry, and you can check out details of the trigger warnings on our website.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Labels Podcast. I am Lucy, and I'm here with Alice. Hello, Alice.
I've done it again. I've got my microphone a mile away from me.
Honestly, professional to the end.
2 episodes in a row.
Yeah.
Hi, Lucy.
Hi. You all right? Everything? You got everything?
It's been a bit of a hectic morning. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to be sitting down in one place where I sort of feel like can't cause it too much more chaos.
I was trying to be sympathetic to Alice's kind of very fraught day today, but I was shoving celery and hummus in my mouth, so I couldn't hear what she was saying. I was like,
oh, now she tells me once I'd finished pouring my heart out.
Fine, I heard most of it. 95% of it. never mind, this always cheers us up though, doesn't it?
Yes, I did say I was looking forward to recording because I was hoping it would cheer me up. We never know what's going to happen in an episode,
so hold on to your hats, ladies and gentlemen.
We our guest with us this week, who now has all the pressure of dealing with our emotional baggage and lifting me out of the gloom, is Leo. If you'd like to introduce yourself.
Hi, my name's Leo. My pronouns are he, him. And I am a filmmaker from rural Oregon, currently living in New York City.
Oh, God, rural Oregon. What is that like?
Bad.
I can imagine anyone who chooses to leave somewhere that is literally rural Oregon to move to New York can't think like farmhouses and then nothing for miles and miles and miles is a good thing.
Right. Yeah. Well, and it's funny because I had a very odd childhood. Grew up on a farm in the middle of nowhere with a lot of religious cults, and I was also homeschooled. Which was a whole mess in and of itself. And so very, very odd kind of situation there. And somehow I managed to get out.
I mean, it sounds like you probably had 3 choices. It was, you know, farmer, cult member, or just getting the fuck out.
Basically. Well, and at that point, they wouldn't have accepted me because I was a bit of a pariah in society at that point due to my queerness and emerging disability. So, you know, that was a time.
Yeah, the cults, they do like a productive cult member.
They do. Yeah. You can't do something. They're like, well, what's the point of you? We need you to promote our creepy alt-right propaganda.
We haven't got any chairs for you to sit in the corner, so don't quite know what to do with you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's fine. It means that all us disabled folk, we're majority safe.
We've got our own cult.
Yeah. Disability Twitter does feel a bit like that sometimes.
Very true.
Yeah.
Very true.
Like shouting into a void.
Yep.
So you said you had a bit of an odd childhood. Why don't you tell us a little bit about kind of that experience of growing up? Being LGBTQ+ and disabled, kind of, you know, in that rural religious, because I can't, I mean, neither Lucy or I live in like big cities in the UK, but I can't imagine. I think the rural experience in America is unfathomable, really, yeah. compared to, you know, the rural experience here is everybody's just a bit horsey.
True.
Surprisingly posh and a bit horsey.
Horse, pub, posh, basically.
Yeah, that's
Yeah, it was very strange. So I was homeschooled until I was 11. And then I was shipped off to Catholic school for a year, which went very badly. And had to leave that school. They also kind of didn't want me there after a year. So, but yeah, so it was, so my disability is a bit strange in the sense that there is the neurodivergent aspect and the chronic illness aspect. So both went undiagnosed for a very long time, but the chronic illness that I have actually developed, it's a post-viral chronic illness. It's very similar to long COVID. It's called POTS, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. And I started developing that around middle school after I got really, really sick. And so for a long time though, because this would have been 2011, and we're also out in the middle of nowhere, there was no way to tell what was wrong with me. And because of the symptoms, I had to deal with a lot of basically harassment and bullying because that I wasn't trying hard enough, because it's fatigue, chronic nausea. So I wasn't able to eat oftentimes, and lightheadedness, because your entire nervous system is completely shot. So I was really struggling to do things. I was, for a long time, I really wanted to be a professional dancer. And so I was studying dance at this time. And I had to quit in early high school because I couldn't physically do it anymore. And it was really frustrating because I was, you know, blacking out in dance and things like that. People were like, well, what's wrong with you? Like, you're just not fit enough. You need to be working even harder to be more physically fit so that you stop, you know, passing out, things like that, which is the opposite of what you're supposed to do. And and amidst all of this as well, I was going through a very big sexuality crisis of not knowing anything. I was very isolated from the internet and from pop culture. And, you know, this was still early 2010s at this point. So the first time I ever was introduced to the concept of what gay was when I managed to sneak an episode of Glee and was like, well, I guess this is the entirety of what being a gay is.
You immediately join a choir.
Yeah. I was gonna say, you can't really get more more kind of stereotypical flamboyant gay musical theater.
It was very weird. Looking back, it was a very weird program, wasn't it?
It absolutely was. And at the time, I was taking it as gospel because I was like, this is the outside world and I don't know anything about the outside world. So and so it was really wild. And I also struggled a lot because I continually tried to have these conversations where I didn't even know. So I knew that you could be gay. That was it. I didn't know that. I was like, there's no such thing as lesbians. What is a lesbian?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and it's
and I also didn't know what bisexual meant, and I identify as bisexual. And I would try to have these conversations where I was like, well, I don't understand, because I think, like, I have these crushes on guys and I have these crushes on girls, and everybody would be like, well, I don't know what's wrong with you. But also the fact that you know, because I was assigned female at birth and was like, also couldn't talk about having crushes on other girls because that was considered like predatory and all of this other stuff, all of this very typical homophobia in rural areas, and faced a lot of bullying and harassment because of the religious element of the town that was constantly like, you're gonna burn in hell, etc. Mm-hmm. etc. Mm-hmm. And this would just happen in classrooms, and the teachers are like, you know how it is, and I'm like, cool, thanks for nothing.
Wow. Jesus. Yeah.
So yeah, it was a bit of a shit show, and it took a lot of like me kind of separating myself from the town and being like, I kind of wrote about this in my article for Respectability, where once I reached high school, because then I started going to public high school, which was a huge shift for me.
Yeah.
And I was like, I have to just kind of accept that if I'm going to be a problem wherever I am, then so be it. Mm. And that was really freeing. And, you know, there's a lot of long-term harm in being like, you know, I'm the terrible person that everybody says I am kind of thing. But also when you're 14, it's like, all right, well, maybe if I just accept that for a bit, then the harassment will feel less mm-hmm. brutal mm. because then it can't affect you. Right. If somebody's like, you suck. And you're like, I know, then, you know, it yeah. supposedly.
Where does that insult go?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. When you sort of think like, you guys can't hate me or think any less of me than I think of myself. It's just right. like, what you're throwing at me is a drop in the ocean.
Yeah,
like right. I think a lot of people who have kind of differences that make them feel excluded or isolated do that a lot in their teenage years to protect themselves.
Yeah.
You know, it's, Absolutely.
And it was a very strange experience at that high school because there were a lot more, the way I phrase it, a lot more normal kids there, because prior to that, in the homeschool groups, I was dealing with a lot of like evangelical, alt-right, religious, like really concerning shit there within itself. Yeah. And then going to Catholic school, which was also a shit show because I was the only non-Catholic there and got my first physical fight, and a lot of stuff went down there. And so by the time I got to high school, I'm surrounded by a much wider variety of kids, but also really exposed to a very specific kind of culture, the public school culture that I was not at all indoctrinated in, had no idea how to navigate. And it was really strange because these kids were also still ultimately public school in a very rural area. And this is still early. This would have been 2012. And so a lot of these kids also, including myself, were still not fully in social media era. And so, like, for instance, I got labeled as this like scary emo kid because I wore a black leather jacket from like Goodwill. Like, I mean, like, it wasn't even like, you know, like a punk. I wish it had been like a cool punk with like spikes. It was like, I wore a black leather jacket. These kids are like, you're an evil, emo, scary monster. Like,
I think me and you, Leo, would have been friends in high school, because when I went, my experience of like education and things, slightly different to yours. So I went to a special school when I was 3 years old and didn't leave that school until I was getting on for 17, 18. And then, so I went to a mainstream college, which is like non-disabled people and me. I was the first one to go to college who was in a wheelchair. So everybody was on like high alert of, oh, she's coming. Like, and for the first 2 weeks, nobody spoke to me because they were like, I don't quite know how to deal with this thing in the chair. And then we went out and did some filming with them. And I was made to go out in a small group to do this filming, and we came back after like 3 hours, and this lad walked into the classroom and he went, it's all right, lad, she's fine, she's not gonna cry, it's fine, you can ask her anything like this. But we got on so well that me and this friend of mine got on so well that he got sick of people asking him what was wrong with me. So we made up several stories because I used to wear a leather jacket and look quite scary. And I didn't think I looked scary, but apparently I did, because he made up three alternative stories. One was that I fell off a motorbike and crashed and like damaged my legs. Didn't. One that was me and him were ballroom dancing champions when we were kids. And he landed on my leg and broke it awkwardly, and I've never been able to walk since. And the other ones that I was rescuing orphans from Africa, and they were all like, these people were like, oh my God, really? Like, so I just go, I'm really sorry, none of that. I know I wear a leather jacket and I look quite scary, but I'm just, it just happened at birth, it's fine. They were like, oh. But yeah, so I think it's that whole people not really knowing how to just sort of deal with it. They're like, oh, like me and another friend of mine became friends because he was late to the college course and they'd all made their friends and stuff. So he found it really difficult to make friends. So me and this like really tall 6'6" lanky lad who was also a bit socially awkward, we were like just like Tweedledum and Tweedledee really. But it's, I just find it bizarre how kids of that age, they just don't know what to do they? They're like, I don't know what I'm going to do with this disabled person. I'll just sit here and just stare at her, you know, for hours on end, which then makes you feel awkward.
See, for me, being a quote-unquote scary emo, like, I found my tribe. Like, all my girlfriends, who I'm still friends with now, our editor, Adam, like, are my emo friends from, like, high school still. Like, and I am, like, as soon as I discovered that, like, you know, black nail polish, like, was the way forward, and guys wearing eyeliner, I was like, these are my people. This is where I belong.
I have to say, when I go and have my nails done and I, like, plump for black nail polish, I'm like, oh, yeah, I feel quite menacing now. Like yes, paint them black like my soul, that kind of thing.
It was very interesting because I ultimately was able to, I made three best friends that are still my best friends to this day. But it was really funny because, so one of my best friends, Ava, so the other thing I wore with this black jacket was this like really dorky, like beanie/beret situation.
Yeah, amazing.
I had a friend who wore one very similar.
Yeah. It was 2012. You know, it was a different time. Because I was really quiet, there was this time when this one girl who I had been like kind of friends with in the class introduced me to Ava, my now best friend. And we had been in class together for months at this point. We had like multiple classes together. And when she introduced me and I was like, oh, hi. She was like, you speak English?
Oh, I thought, no.
she's like, she genuinely was like, I thought you were a French foreign exchange student. And I said, you are batshit. We are going to be friends forever. And we're still best friends. Yeah, and I love her to death. Awesome. It was one of those things where you're like, to your point, like you have to have those really awkward meetings with people that like cut through everything else. And you're like, all right, we're tight for life now.
So after that 2 weeks of nobody speaking to me, when we went out to do this filming, and I was like, oh my God, they're going to feel awkward, which is going to make me feel awkward. And I was pushing myself over a cobbled street down the high street. And it was making my chair shake so much that my shoe fell off. And because I can't put my own shoes on because I can't reach my feet. Mm. And I was like, what do I do? Because like these guys won't speak to me and I need somebody to help me put my shoe back on. So I said to my friend, I was like, I'm really sorry to ask you, but can you put my shoe back on? And he looked at me and he was like, what? I said, can you put my shoe back on? He was like, what do you mean? I was like, it's fallen off, it's behind us, like this. He went, shall I just take you to the local shoe shop? I was like, no, just put my shoe on.
We need a professional involved here. I can't possibly do this.
He put my shoe on, and this woman's like staring at us because it's bizarre. And he was like, he went, what are you staring at? Like, it's this woman, and she's like, oh, he goes, it's street theatre, we're doing Cinderella like this. But I think that broke the ice, you see?
Yeah.
He had to put my shoe on.
Yeah, it was, I, in college, so I started using a cane in college, And I really just like to make things really just even more socially difficult for myself and just make things as awkward as possible for my cohort. Because so I was in this small, I studied film and television production at USC, which was also a nightmare for a variety of different reasons. That school is super corrupt. Do not recommend. And I, halfway through school, I came out as trans and started using a cane, because which for a variety of reasons. And it was really awkward in a lot of ways. I was the only trans person in my cohort. I was the only openly disabled person in my cohort now. And so, they hadn't really known what to do with me before being this like country, because most of them were rich kids who grew up in art schools, were, you know, had relatives in the film industry. Mm-hmm. And so then this is all in Los Angeles. And so they kind of had their own thing and didn't really know what to do with me. And I didn't really know what to do with them. Because again, the person, like the culture was so different, you know, growing up in where I did, it was very much like a talk shit, get hit kind of situation. And these kids were all like saying terrible things and, you know, just a lot of bigotry and just a lot of general assholery. And when I would call their bluff on it, they're like, well, you need to be like, there was this whole culture of you need to be nice to each other because they could be your boss one day. Mm-hmm. And I was like, and this would be from professors too, who are like, you cannot, you have to do this whole pretense thing. And it's like, but they're directly saying stuff that's like super racist. And it's like, yeah, but don't call them out on it. I'm like, what the fuck? Like, what are we doing here? Yeah, you guys, this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
So yeah, once I got, then I became even more of the weird kid in class when I started using a cane and was also trans. I am trans, and everybody's like, I don't know what to do with you. And I was like, all right, guys, you know, whatever. I don't know what to do with
y'all
either.
I really wish you, when you said earlier about kind of embracing, like, you know, if I'm going to be a problem everywhere, then I'm just going to embrace it. I wish that through my like teens and right into my like till like I was 25, I really wish I'd embraced that kind of being a problem, being the different one, and just kind of jumped in full force with like, you know, both feet. Like, I listening to you talking about like, you know, you're transitioning from female to male, you're walking around with a cane. My immediate thought is fucking cane, top hat, bow tie, every bastard day, and be like, yeah, come on then, let's fucking go. And I mean, I'm legally blind. I didn't use a cane or a guide dog until I was like 26. I just fucking risked it. And my social life and the stuff I got up to was definitely limited by the fact that I had to rely on other people to kind of get me around. Mm-hmm. And like, now I see people on Twitter who have got like orientation canes that are like glittery and stuff like that. And I'm like, that, if I'd done that, I would have had six. I would have coordinated my fucking outfits with them. If I had known then how awesome I would feel if I had something like that. Like, but you're just so desperate not to rock the boat when you're that age. You're just so desperate to find your place amongst people and not feel like you're standing out. Whereas, like, I love standing out. I love being the center of attention now. I'm like, fucking, yeah, look at me.
When I was growing up, I had National Health Service wheelchairs, which were big, clunky, ugly looking. They swamped me basically as a small child. It was like tiny, really like Tiny Tim type of, she looked very sickly and ill. And then when I got to like my teenage years, and you know, you could pay privately for wheelchairs, I was like, right, I'm gonna pay for my own. And I'm gonna, like, I have had wheelchairs that looking back now are the most disgusting colors you could ever put together. But as a 10-year-old, I was like, yeah, I want pink and gold trim. Like, yeah. it wasn't gold, it actually looked like cow poo color, which was,
that's definitely not gold.
No, it's not gold. Not,
I don't know what the cows are like where you live, Luke. No,
but like, and I think to a wider extent as well, that's why I dye my hair bright colors, because it's like, I know they're going to be looking at me. Why not give them something to look at? Do you know what I mean? And it's like when people say to me, oh, I don't notice you in a wheelchair. I'm like, why not? This chair cost me like thousands and thousands of pounds. Look at it. It's beautiful. That kind of thing. Once you get to that stage in life, it's extremely freeing because you think, oh,
yeah,
you know, at least they're looking at something nice, not something that makes me look like ill and infirm. Do you know what I mean? It's that taking ownership of it, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's tricky too, because there's just so much, I mean, there's a lack of representation of what's possible, to your point, Alice, about like just not knowing. I mean, the reason that I felt comfortable to start using a cane was because of a character in a book I read that like really meant a lot to me. And this character had a lot of the same issues I have and used a cane and was incredibly badass. And I was like, I didn't know that those things could coexist.
Yeah.
And that like, and it was one of those things I was like, oh, and especially also doing more research into disability justice. And because once I was officially diagnosed, the whole world kind of opened up and it was like, okay, now I kind of understand. Because that's the other thing too, is that I also didn't know until I got to college that I didn't know what being trans was. I didn't know really what disability was besides the one singular image of like, I guess, people in wheelchairs. Like, yeah. It was just a complete lack of understanding anything. And once I got to college, I was just learning so much. And then doing more work into disability and learning about all these things of like, if a mobility aid helps you, why not use it? Like, you don't have to have a certain, you don't have to fit a certain mold of like, you know, these are the requirements for you to use a mobility.
Nobody's got like a checklist of want to use a stick, you want to use a cane. Like, let's go through this 15-point plan of
you qualify?
Yeah, I think and I think as well, you know, people that I've spoken to who have put off using a mobility aid up until like recently, they've said like it's a huge weight off that as soon as you start using it, you're like, because you feel more comfortable in yourself because you're not in pain and stuff, and you feel like you can enjoy life again, which I don't think people who sort of have acquired their disability, they think, oh, I'm going to need to use a wheelchair in the end and all, and so they fight it for as long as possible. But actually, once you've got it, it's like, oh, I can breathe.
It's that idea that it will make you dependent, whereas actually, like, I mean, certainly from my experience before I started, you know, using a cane and having guide dogs, I was less independent beforehand. I was dependent on other people. And like, I think, you know, I would, you know, my parents always used to say to me, you can do whatever you want. Don't worry about having a disability. You can do anything you want to do. And one of the things I always wanted to do was go to university. But I specifically decided to go to university up the road from my mum's house because I believed that I would need to be near my mum for support because I can't see. And I know someone with the same eye condition as me who started using a guide dog, I think, just before she started college. She's also American. And she, as part of her undergrad, studied in Italy for a year.
Wow.
She moved from Wisconsin to Washington for her undergrad. And then she did her master's over here, like in the UK. And that's because she went, like, have dog will travel. Yeah. And like, I think, like, don't get me wrong, I had a great time at uni. And, you know, if I hadn't gone to the uni that I went to, I probably never would have wound up where I am with my husband and stuff like that. But I am also the sort of person who's quite like, I like trying new things. I like sort of adventures. And I think if I'd been using, particularly, I think if I had had a dog and the confidence of having a guide dog that brings me, I would have gone, fuck it, let's go to Edinburgh. Let's go. I could stick a pin in a map. That's where I'm going to uni, rather than very much limiting myself to like 25 miles from my mum's front door. Yeah, I think people really see accepting AIDS and accepting that people are going to look at you and go, oh, they're disabled. Mm-hmm. That's a bad thing.
Yeah. There's still so much stigma around it, isn't it? Like, mm-hmm. you know, we get so many people, or me and Alice do, I don't know about you, Leo, who refuse to refer to us as disabled people. No matter how much we go, actually, no, it's fine. You can call me disabled. It's absolutely fine. They go, no. Those words will never cross my mind. Well, at work.
Like it's a dirty word.
Yeah.
Like calling us disabled is insulting us.
At work, I have put on my email signature, because obviously everything is done in Zoom type situations, so you can't necessarily see my wheelchair unless I back up about 4 feet away from the camera. And I've put on my email signature, I identify as a disabled person, I have cerebral palsy. It's just very matter of fact there. Somebody actually, I sent them an email about something, and they emailed me back and they're like, I've just noticed your signature, it's very progressive. And I'm like, not really. Like, I'm just telling you that I'm disabled in case you...
A fact.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, everybody's putting their pronouns on their email signature.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, it needs to say Alice Evans, she, her, blind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then every other, like, descriptive word for like, paragraph long. But yeah, they were like, oh, it's very progressive. I was like, not really. I've had this all of my life. And it just helped. It just breaks that conversation. Nobody's going to have that weird conversation now of, oh, are you disabled? I didn't realise.
Do you think, Leo, that from kind of, you know, being kind of inspired by that representation of having a character with a mobility aid that kind of inspired you to start using a mobility aid, is that something that you're bringing into your filmmaking?
Oh, absolutely. And I will say one of the things that really, because this character like really just like truly means and meant a lot to me. They made an
adaptation. I do have to ask who it is.
Kaz Brekker from Six of Crows.
Oh my God. I love him. I love him so much. What do you think of the casting choice for the TV show?
Awful. Terrible.
Really?
He's not disabled.
No, he's not disabled. I think in terms of his personality, he pulls that. I think the personality works quite well. But yeah, okay. I'll give you... We should be casting disabled people in disabled roles.
Yeah,
he's also the other thing. I have a lot of criticisms of the TV show because they also instead of hiring a stunt double for the actress playing Inej, who is of the same ethnicity,
yeah,
they put a white woman in brownface.
Oh my God, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh my God.
What TV show is this? I didn't hear you.
So this is Shadow and Bone, which is the adaptation on Netflix. And it's in my opinion, garbage fire. And a lot of other people have a lot of people who are better equipped to analyze. There's also the fact that there's a lot of colorism and fatphobia as well in the casting. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I'm not going to speak on that as somebody with as a white, relatively thin person. I'm not going to be like, yeah, here's my opinion on that. But I know that there's a lot of really great articles out there about people who are like, this casting is not okay. And I will speak to specifically the casting of Kaz. I was really disappointed that they cast able-bodied actor, because I was like, what are you guys doing here? Like, it's just, and they also just,
It's a pretty key part of his identity, isn't it? Mm-hmm. The fact that he's got a walking impairment.
Well, and the actor talks about like pretending, like he was like, to get into character, I was walking around with a limp in my apartment.
Don't even get me started.
That's in an interview.
I wrote my uni like end of year thing.
Dissertation.
That's the one. I was going to say thesis, but it's not that. On the fact that disability representation, and I rambled on for about 34 pages of it's not right, blah, blah, blah. And you know, because they always go back to the same excuse of, oh, we can't accommodate them on set. Well, yeah. Why? And the actors are going to be slower because of their additional needs. No, we're not. Trials. No, we're not.
And that's something that's like, also, if you plan for it from the beginning,
yeah,
right? If you plan production ahead of time and make production accessible, which it just should be regardless. I mean, that's a huge part of what Respectability does and what their production coordinators do is talking about, like, how all sets need to be made accessible because you also don't know who has an undisclosed disability. Mm-hmm. And it's just, because of the nature of the film industry, people are not in a position where they have the power or the comfortability and the safety to openly disclose, hey, this is my disability, because they will often be fired for that. Or you know, will be basically subtly blacklisted out of the industry entirely. And so, it's really important to just have film sets be accessible, even if you don't necessarily have, you know, disabled actors. But even then, it's like, why don't we have more disabled actors? Why don't we have more disabled characters? Why do we even have to? I mean, what was so powerful for me about the element of disability in the Six of Crows books was that it was talking about the impact of disability without it being like
the main narrative.
Yeah, because it was like it was a heist in a fantasy story. Like the thing I always talk about is that, like, I am a filmmaker because I want to make movies about disabled queers in space who are causing problems.
You can cast me and Alice in the lead roles.
I'm like, I want Star Wars, but like disabled and queer and Star Wars, that's a whole other thing. They cast people of color and then wrote really racist storylines and didn't defend the actors from all the racism online. Mm-hmm. But I love those stories. I'm not really interested in stories set in the real world because I live in the real world and I don't really find that entertaining to watch personally. That is 100% just me personally. I understand that there's a lot of value in, you know, coming out stories like Love, Simon was really impactful and things like that. So, but for me, it's like, I want to make stories about adventures and actually be able to see myself.
Yeah. Do you think, Leo, that your imagination is enhanced because you are disabled and because you have gone through an alternative sort of journey to where you are now? It's not been as straightforward, has it, for us as a collective, really, growing up? I often think that my imagination, I run away with myself, and before you know it, I've got big ideas and big plans, and I'm like, whoa, like,
she started going on the other day about how when we have an office and we do this, and I'm like, Lucy. I was gonna say, just, we couldn't even afford a fucking water cooler at the minute between the two of us. Never mind an office.
Might just be able to afford coffee.
If you guys would like to help us, help donate to the show to buy us a water cooler or a coffee machine or an office. Yeah,
for the low price of 99 cents a month, you too can help.
We have a GoFundMe. Go and donate to the GoFundMe.
Exactly.
And that's my. I apologize, Leo. I make it my personal mission.
Like rams it in the middle of an.
If you are able bodied, if you are a non disabled person listening to this podcast, it is your obligation to donate. Otherwise, you're a terrible person and you should feel bad about yourself.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to, like, drop food down my trousers and just make it look like I can't feed myself properly and then cry on camera.
We'll put some adverts out on ITV in between, like, in between those terrible midday, like, old lady mystery TV shows. Like, and it'll be starving children in Africa,
me,
us, and then donkeys.
Oh my god.
I do wonder whether, like, because we have had like a bit of a we're a bit like strangers in society, aren't we, really? Like, nobody really gets us. I often have thought to myself, I wonder if, like, my imagination runs away with me because I am disabled and haven't had the same creative opportunities or what it is, but because I have a different view of the world, whether that's informed my imagination that just goes off on one.
Yeah, I mean, part of the reason that I became obsessed with storytelling was because when I was younger and growing up on a farm, homeschooled, I was very, very isolated. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have I wasn't surrounded by my own peers, and I wasn't really, you know, it was a very isolating kind of childhood. And so the few times when I would go to, you know, my dance studio or things like that, it was very much still the outsider, the weird kid, because these kids were coming in from public school and I was like, didn't speak their language basically for all intents and purposes. Mm. And so
You were the French foreign exchange student.
Yes. Yes. Of course. Of course. Could not be more French. Me, born and raised in Oregon, only speak English.
But get under your arm.
Yeah. But yeah, and so I started reading a lot, and until my ADHD developed and caused a lot of problems for me with my ability to focus, I was reading a book a day growing up, and I was obsessed with Nancy Drew books.
Loved Nancy Drew, yes, when I was a kid.
Yes, Nancy Drew is the best. My siblings, we would play the Nancy Drew PC games.
Oh, wow.
Which, you know, the graphics are very like 2008. It's good. Tamara Pierce's books, which are fantasy. I was obsessed with history. And so I was just reading a ton and was like, I also, my dad is a big sci-fi fan. And so I also grew up watching Star Trek and, Star Wars, and the show Quantum Leap, which I still love a lot. And so growing up with those stories, it was like, I did not basically have the ability to experience the world. No. And so I was experiencing the world through all of these stories.
Yeah.
And so it became really important to me because it is, as I became obsessed with more and more TV shows and really actually started to like hone in on it as something I wanted to do for a career, was tell stories through this format as dance became inaccessible to me. It saved my life in high school because my mental health was so bad and things in my life were so bad for a variety of reasons. And I was dealing with a lot of abuse. And so having those stories saved my life, and knowing how important that is, I was like, I just want to be able to tell those kind of stories that provide an escape and tell a lot of meaningful, and there's also a lot of room. One of the reasons I love sci-fi is because of how political it is. There's also just a lot of room for really important political discussions and the importance of being educated on all of these elements of our society and what we can do to change the world for the better. And all of the things, especially as a white person, like we have to unpack and address white supremacy and U.S. imperialism as an American citizen and all of this other stuff that's like really also tied into my storytelling, where it's like, I want to provide this escape, but I also know how intrinsically important all these other things are, right? Because it's like, we can't fully have disability justice until we address accessibility and, you know, ableism. And with that, with addressing ableism comes addressing capitalism, right?
Yeah.
Because capitalism specifically created the category of disability. So the stories that I really want to tell are about giving space for marginalized voices and marginalized stories while also addressing the underlying things that make us marginalized to begin with, right?
Yeah. And I do think that is one of the really powerful things about fantasy and science fiction. I am like, fantasy books and anime were my friends when I was like 14.
Yeah.
until I moved up here and made friends with actual people.
I thought you were gonna say until you made friends with me. I was like, hi.
No, I until I made friends with Adam, and I realized I sounded super disgusted.
No,
I was like, no. Ugh, Lucy. No, I just mean that I did have some experience with talking to other human beings before you, Lucy. Fine.
You peaked when you met me, though, didn't you? Like, it was like, can't get any better than this.
Fantasy fiction, and I grew up reading the Harry Potter books as the Harry Potter books were coming out. Mm-hmm. So, like, the first one was out in 98 when I turned 11. Mm-hmm. You know, I can remember sitting up until 4 o'clock in the morning to finish The Hobbit. The first time I skived off school was to finish the last book in the His Dark Materials original trilogy. For me, that's what kind of those fantasy things, they open up the world without you necessarily realizing that they're opening the world up to you, and they start to get you thinking about not necessarily about the systems that you're seeing, but the way that you understand and feel about things when they happen. Mm-hmm. So that then when you see those things happening in those systems, and I think that actually is more impactful, because if you stand in front of somebody and you say, this is wrong because of this, capitalism is bad because of this, the conservatives are bad because of this, whereas if you tell people a story where it builds and they learn and they realize
this, the characters,
and this is how I feel about this situation. Mm-hmm. When it's then presented to them in reality, they go, oh, I see this, you know, from this new light now.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's kind of like feeding, you know, the animals the medicine in treats. It's like, all right, you just gotta you gotta hide it. But it's, yeah, I mean, one of the stories that really had a huge impact on me that I got in trouble for reading during class was the Hunger Games series. Okay. Because that's kind of what was coming out when I was growing up in set, because the first movie came out when I was in eighth grade. And so that was really impactful for me. And also just from a disability standpoint, I mean, they don't really like, they don't address it in the movies, but in the books, Katniss becomes disabled and Peeta becomes disabled.
Yeah.
And so that's also a very political book. And I thought is just like a fantastic, like basically primer as a, you know, when you're in middle school and your brain is kind of like, I'm a sponge, basically. It was a great time to read this book and be like, oh, I also I've also been very resistant to authority from a very young age because of, one, all of the really abusive institutions that I ended up being stuck in, and because of myself, ended up being targeted by authority a lot of the time. So I, you know, was very rebellious already, but just this kind of like, there is a reason why we should question things, because these institutions and these systems that we have serve a specific purpose and serve a specific kind of person.
And you know what I really loved about the Hunger Games was at the very end, where and I can't remember the other characters, she's like got that love triangle with Peeta
and Gail.
That's it, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the fact that she chooses Peeta, the reason really behind that is a moral decision. You know, she, despite the fact that there's a connection and they have a bond and there's obviously an attraction there, what she decides to do in the end is go, actually, I can't be with somebody who would make this decision. Mm-hmm. I, you know, morally, I need to be with someone who is, and I think when you're like 14, 15, 16, that, I mean, I read those books when I was in my mid-20s, but I think that's probably a really, so many stories that are told to young people about relationships are those kind of high drama, like almost abusive, gaslighting, like Twilight type mm-hmm. relationship.
So, yeah, the amount of time I've waited. And Robert my God.
I think that that's sort of that those books really challenge that, and I really like that about those books.
Yeah, it was very like it broke the mold in a lot of ways because of who she ends up with, and also the ending of the book is very different than a lot of other stories would have been in that era, because she, you know, she works so hard. Well, one, she doesn't even really want to be a part of this revolution, which I thought was really, you know, you read these stories about like, I want to, you know, these kids that are like, I'm going to, you know, lead the revolution. And it was much more about the reality of how, you know, these people in terrible situations end up being the face of these movements that they don't want to be. It's just, they want to be able to live in peace, right?
Yeah.
It's not a fun thing to be, you know, a part of this revolution, right? And so, but then ultimately this system is replaced, and the new system that they have in, she sees, is going to cause identical problems.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was also really impactful, just in terms of like, it just really delved into a lot of things that I don't know if, the other thing too is that like, the way that I noticed that, and a lot of other people did in retrospect too, was like, when the movies were being made, they also like embraced the ironic side of it without fully understanding what they were doing, because they were like, here's the makeup line inspired by the Hunger Games. I'm like, do you see what you're doing? Like, they're like, oh, you know, Hollywood, like in many ways is representative of the capital in that series. And they were going on and on about like the fashion of the movies and how you can look like the characters. I'm like, that's what the books are about.
Yeah.
Like, it was wild. So the people who just saw the movies and like, just kind of saw the thing around it and like didn't read the books, missed out on this whole thing where I was like, the books are literally critiquing what the film industry is doing like, with the movies. But yeah, so it definitely was like, and it also was, you know, a lot of other dystopia was kind of like the genre for a while after that, but I don't think any other series came close to to really saying as many impactful things as The Hunger Games did, because most of them were just, you know, more blatant ripoffs that didn't really do a whole lot with the genre, even though they could have. But yeah,
I'm trying to think if there is a film, if I've ever seen a film that was adapted from a book where I've gone, yeah, that was as good as.
No, I don't. I don't think I've ever seen a film that is better than.
What about Percy Jackson?
I was so cross at the end of that movie. I was like, this is shit.
Well, we're getting the new remake with it, so maybe that'll be good.
Oh, don't make me sit through it again, Leo. No.
If you want a reminder of even worse adaptation, there is always the Avatar: The Last Airbender film adaptation.
I'm all right, thanks.
No. I went to see The Lovely Bones. I can remember going and seeing that, and I was really disappointed because I'd read the book beforehand. And I was like, this is terrible.
I really didn't like that book. No. I thought it was really boring. I was bored all the way through.
How are we friends, Alice?
We're not really. Is this just helped up?
Super we're like convenient. Richard and Judy, but it's like a fake show. Yeah, we really get on. Judy Finnegan hates Richard Madeley, if you ask me. She cannot stand him. Leo has no idea what I'm talking about. I'll send you some clips. You'll be able to see absolute venom coming out of her mouth.
Oh, no.
They're a married TV presenting couple.
Oh, gotcha.
Who hate one another.
Well,
I mean, they've been married for about 45 years.
I just assume that's how straight marriages work. I don't really...
Harboring some sort of...
Deep resentment.
Yeah. But yeah, no,
I'm not going to comment, having just celebrated my 5th wedding anniversary.
Do you harbor a deep resentment?
No, I love my husband very much. Okay. I think I paused for too long.
We'll take it out, Eddie. It's fine. We'll take it out. I can't think of a book that I've read that I've gone, yes. Really,
where you thought the TV show was better.
Harry Potter. No, because Harry Potter, like the only thing about Harry Potter was the fact that in my head, Harry Potter was exactly the same as he was on screen. But that was just how my head had gone. Oh, that's what
he mean, they cast Daniel Radcliffe for his appearance. Yes. They did not cast him for his acting skills.
No, they did not.
They could paint a pair of glasses on a wooden spoon. And
there is something about Daniel Radcliffe that I don't like. And I
think he's got a very punchable face.
Yeah, I don't know what... That's why we're friends, Alice.
Mutual hatred and Harry Potter.
There's something about that makes me go, oh, no, I don't know. There's something weird there. I don't know what it is. I often think your imagination is the best tool, really. And if you've gone to the trouble of reading a book, don't go and see the film.
Well, it's tricky because it's a completely different medium, and I think that the best way to do an adaptation is to not necessarily try to it's more about figuring out what the essence of the story is, because you're not going to be able to, you're going to end up telling a very specific version of the book.
Yeah.
And that's really tricky to do. It's not easy at all, but it's that whole thing of the power of reading a book is that we can all picture it differently.
Yeah.
And that's just not something that can translate to the screen. And so it's really tricky to do, especially. But I think the other factor that comes into it a lot of times with bad adaptations is it's just more about money than it is about actually telling the story in a different and interesting way.
I think people get blinded by Hollywood, don't they? And they go, oh yeah, this is fancy and swanky, and yes, thank you very much. I'll take your $1 million budget and all this kind of stuff, and then
and Hollywood cashing in on popular books and I think actually it takes a real skill to draw something out of a book and put it, put it onto a screen. Mm. And sometimes when you're just going, right, let's get this out before the hype around the book disappears. Right.
Yeah, exactly. And as well, Hollywood like to take away the nasty, horrible bits out of any, they don't focus on disability. Don't focus on this. Don't focus on the fact that,
Unless the film is specifically about a horrible thing that happened to a disabled person or a person of color.
Oh, yeah. And then aren't you glad you're not them?
Yeah.
What was that one with, I think it was Emilia Clarke.
Me Before You?
Yeah.
I can hear how angry you are.
Oh, it was just, so many reasons, just terrible, but just
That was an hour and a half of inspiration porn just rammed down your throat, wasn't it, really?
No, and the tricky thing too in terms of telling more marginalized stories is that because of how, for a variety of reasons, but especially just because of how the industry is shrinking down to these monopolies, they will really only tell stories that have previous IPs. So you can't really get a movie made unless it's based off of something else. You can't get a TV show made unless it's based off of something else, because then it's guaranteed to have a successful audience, which makes it hard because it's then you can't come in and be I have this fresh new story. It's where is the published book podcast that this is based on, and all this other stuff that just is more, again, just that it's inaccessible in a lot of ways, because then it requires you to have all of this other work that you've created magically out of nowhere to prove that you have an audience for this, because it's just so hard to get anybody to take a chance on telling these stories, even though time and time again they've proved financially successful, in terms of I think Black Panther,
and again, I mean, that's one of the things that I did, that Black Panther did well, is is drawing on those kind of authentic voices and authentic experiences. And when actually what you're doing is going, well, what's the most popular thing amongst the movie going population, is that there are actually huge parts of groups in society that aren't paying to go to the cinema because they can't afford it, because it's not accessible, because they have to work two jobs, because they don't want to pay what is £15, $25 or something to go see a film that's not about them.
Right, right.
So what you're doing is going, well, what's popular amongst cinema audiences? And that is a very specific niche group of, exactly, of people. And so what's popular amongst them is the same stuff because it's the same things representing like the same people.
It's shooting fish in a barrel, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
You know, captive audience. All right, let's hit them with this. That's why there is so much Marvel, you know, stuff out that just constantly on a...
Well, Marvel's also because the U.S. military pays a lot of money for that propaganda, but, you know.
And I think one of the things that is interesting about the Marvel films is that there is that huge and quite diverse back catalogue there that is, you know, in bits and pieces being drawn up upon. You know, we have had a Black Panther movie. They are doing Lady Thor.
And She-Hulk as well.
And we've had, you know, blind superheroes out there, but we've done that standalone Black Panther movie, and I know obviously Chadwick Boseman is no longer with us, but you sort of go, can we extend that out, you know? My husband's big into the Marvel movies, and we were having a conversation about spoiler alert, about now that Iron Man's gone, you know, who picks up that mantle. And he was telling me about, I think the character's called Ironheart.
Riri Williams. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, how amazing would it be to see that character, main character, on screen in the Avengers, you know, a woman of color in the Iron Man suit. Mm-hmm. That would be amazing. Mm-hmm. But we won't get that.
No.
They won't pay for that.
It's a step too far, isn't it, really?
Well, and it's also tricky, too, because then what they'd have to do in order to make it good is they'd have to actually hire more marginalized filmmakers behind the camera writing the script, right? I mean, like, what made Black Panther good besides just the incredible talent and, you know, amount of, like, incredible work that just went into it on so many levels from the cast and crew was the fact that, like, they weren't going, oh, okay, we're gonna, you know, stick one black character in this movie and call it good. I mean, it's like, you have to, like, actually embrace, like, you know, if you're gonna tell a story about a disabled character, you need to then embrace it. Like, you know, we don't want it to be the entire script was just nonstop talking about the disability, but there's, like, a whole lens, a whole lived perspective that you're going to bring to that. That you only have if you are part of that community. You know? And so that's the other thing.
It's authentic voices. I'm always talking about how important it is to have authentic voices in storytelling. And I'm sorry, but in the nicest way possible, you can, you know, you might write a bestseller, and I can't remember the woman's name. She writes these pull on your heartstring kind of it's like, is it Jodi Picoult or something and I can remember we did a book club in my old work, and somebody was like, oh, you should read, she's written this book about a black nurse midwife, and these, like, neo-Nazis refuse to let her be in the room when their baby's born, but then she has to come in because it's an emergency and there's no staff, and then the baby dies, and the neo-Nazis are like, oh, well, it's because there was a black woman in the room, and all of this. And I was just like, the fuck is this white woman doing telling this story? Like, good for you that you came up with that in your imagination and you've got the talent and the time and the dedication to sit and write that down, but I'm sorry, that's not your fucking story. Shut your mouth, sit down.
I've never seen you so cross, Alice, about a book. Well, I've never seen you so cross, full stop.
It's authentic storytelling, I think, is possibly going to be the mission that I take with me for the rest of my life. The work I do now, working with people with learning disabilities, I am so sick of looking around and seeing people go, this is what happens to people with learning disabilities, because there is this belief that if you have a learning disability, you cannot cognitively understand and cannot intellectually explain and kind of communicate and verbalize well enough. And it's just bullshit. It just makes me so angry. I've never heard more powerful stories than people telling their own damn stories.
Yeah, yeah, that's the thing. And recently over here in England, there was a program on called Then Barbara Met Alan, and it was about the two people that were instrumental in the Disability Discrimination Act over here in 1995. And that, it made me so emotional, because I knew that the cast and the crew were all disabled. There was a disabled writer, although I don't think he has, his disability has not, like, the condition that was causing his disability has sort of eased a little bit, but he still says he classes himself as a member of the disabled community. He was the writer, and he purposely made sure that the whole cast and crew were disabled as well, which meant there was an authentic story running through the whole thing. And I have never in my life seen a piece of drama that was, it was just showing disabled people as they are, not this inspirational kind of trope, this kind of, oh, they're doing it in spite of their disabilities. They were just human beings. And I was like, this is like a masterclass in how you get it right. I think when you see yourself and you know that that story that is being told is authentic, it gives you like fire in your belly to go, actually, do you know what, there is still hope out there for people to have their minds changed and people to be able to learn from it and not argue the toss about what's best for us.
And you know what, to bring that full circle as well, like when you see yourself and you feel that hope, it just makes you feel more able to go, yeah, this is who I am,
yeah,
and be okay with that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, because so much of what we face with ableism is this like dehumanizing element, mm-hmm, of, you know, being seen as like less than a person. I mean, the amount of times like people will like grab me or something like that when they see my cane, because they're like, oh, you're not, I don't know what they think, but it's like this dehumanizing thing of like, because you're disabled, I don't have to respect your boundaries, your autonomy. Yeah. I had this one woman come up and be like, oh, like, what's wrong with you? Are you contagious? Because I was walking around, this is pre-COVID.
Jesus.
Just walking around with a cane, and she just kept interrogating me. And I was trying to buy a burrito from like a taco truck. I was
leave
like, can I get my burrito? I don't really need to disclose my entire medical history. I just want my burrito.
That 15-point plan again, Leo. It's that 15-point plan. Yeah, yeah. No, I get that a lot. I get, you know, I can remember when I was a teenager, we had a load of like non-disabled children visit school. I don't know what for, but they came en masse. There was about 24 of them.
Trip to the zoo
probably, like, let's go see the poor disabled people,
throw peanuts at them through the bars.
Yeah, careful, they'll lick the windows. Sense of humor. I was tasked with sort of integrating these non-disabled children into the class with other disabled children, and I went to great lengths to explain, you know, that there are some children that won't be able to verbalize, mm-hmm, and there are some children who you might not think understand what you're saying, but know very well what you are saying and have their own minds and everything like this. And they did the morning sessions, and they just stood in the corner, didn't say anything, looking petrified. And I pulled a few of them out, and I was like, what you're not getting the most out of this experience? What is the matter? And they were like, can we catch what these children, can we catch what you've got? And I was like, no, I'm not contagious. I'm not contagious. But if that's your school of thought, then this is what the problem is. It's nothing to do with you're scared of them because they're not making any verbalizing or having any chit chat. You're just scared that to come anywhere near us.
But scared because it's just a different body. Yeah. Never mind what that body's doing or how they're behaving. It's literally, I am scared of you because you're different. And I don't want to catch different from you.
No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and but I have always said that I have been asked every stupid question in the book, and yet I'm still surprised. There are days where I'm like, oh, I've never heard that one before. You know.
Did you get your burrito in the end?
I did. Thankfully, I did get my burrito. And
thank the Lord.
I was like, this burrito better be fucking worth it. And it was. It was worth it.
Amazing. But you just think to yourself, don't you? Why doesn't society just mind their own business?
I mean, that's the biggest thing. Is if everybody could shut the fuck up and mind their own business,
stay in your lane.
The world would be a much better place.
Don't speak until you're spoken to.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Is that again? It's just one of those things of like, we don't have enough conversations about things, right? And so it's also like the forbidden topic of disability.
Yeah.
And then again, just the dehumanizing thing of like only seeing disabled people. Well, the other thing too is that like because of lack of accessibility in society, disabled people often end up like separated from everybody else. So it's like, oh, well, we don't like, I've never seen a person using a wheelchair before out in the city. It's like, why? Have you thought about that? And maybe it's because the sidewalks are completely fucked and they can't get around anywhere.
Yeah.
And like, so that's the other thing too, is that like, it's this cycle of, well, we don't know how to deal with disability because we don't see it. And we don't see it because things aren't accessible, and we won't make things accessible because we don't understand how disability works. And it's just like, so when disabled people are seen, it's kind of like breaking the laws of physics of like, hold up, how did you get through? What are you doing here? Like, it's very alien.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that, when I was watching Daredevil, going back to the Marvel movies, seeing, obviously it was a sighted person playing a blind man, and that's problematic. But I kept saying to my husband, like, that's just not, like, little things, like the way he'd just move around his apartment, super, super confident. And it's like, I get it, you know, I am confident when I move around familiar places.
Yeah.
But also, I legitimately, on a not even probably not weekly basis, probably 3 or 4 times a week, fall over my coffee table because I just don't fucking see it. And I'm confident moving around my house, so confident that I'm not paying attention to where the furniture is. Not once did Daredevil stub his fucking toe. Not once. And I'm just like,
not your representation, is it, babe?
And it's just,
well, that's the super crypt trope, right?
Yeah,
of, like,
true.
And that's the problem. And that, like, I think Daredevil, there's a lot of discussion too about like the importance of, like, again, this was technically like the first blind superhero pretty early on, even though it was played by a sighted actor. But oh my god, I just completely lost my train of thought. Oh, there it went.
Time, don't worry.
Will I get it back?
We'll keep talking at you until it does.
The tension.
I'm just going to say something really deep. That's right. The super crypt trope was about how, like, he still, like, wasn't in a lot of ways. I mean, because the other thing was that, like, he had all of his other senses heightened, so it's like he wasn't blind, so it's like he wasn't disabled. So it's like, okay, so we're still not quite all right. Like,
people ask me that, and every time I meet a new person, they're like, oh, can you hear really well? I'm like, no,
I don't think I asked you that did I
I can't remember. It was just so, honest to god, it's like I have to sort of point out to people, it's like, so what do you think, like, if a person's born without hands, then their feet work really well? It just doesn't make any sense.
My feet don't work. What does that make my other really good bit?
I don't know.
My gob?
I was going to say, you know, super strong, powerful arms that you can weightlift with. And I know it takes some effort to push a chair, but like, I don't think you could deadlift 50 kilos no. just on a Wednesday.
I feel sometimes like my head is going to explode when I pick anything heavy up. I'm like, no, God, no, God, no, no. Yeah, it's bizarre. But again, this whole, well, that's like Daredevil. The fact that he was blind was just like a character trait. There was no exploration into like what it's like to be blind. They just put it in there because in the comics he's blind.
And it's a little bit like, oh, we've done that now. We've got a disabled person. Tick.
Bing. Yeah.
That's the next thing. We've got a woman. We've got a disabled person. What else can we do?
That's it, actually. Those are the only two. There is no.
I'm very interested to see what happens with the new ones that they're doing now that Disney own Marvel. They've got, obviously, Hawkeye is hearing impaired now, and in the Hawkeye TV show the new villain is has hearing loss. Sorry, I apologize to the deaf community. Hearing impaired is not an acceptable phrase. Has hearing loss, and I am really interested to see, because they've cast a woman with hearing loss. She's indigenous as well, so they've really gone full in. Echo, her name is. You know, if they could pull off something really impressive. I'm not holding my breath,
no,
but they've got a really good opportunity. And I'd be very interested to see what they do with her.
The thing that I find quite offensive when it comes to filmmaking and things like that, so what was that film that was out recently with the bloke who was in the band? Jared Leto?
Oh, yeah.
Morpheus?
Morbius.
Morbius. That was a bad movie.
Well,
if you would like to, if listeners, join our Facebook group and you can see me rant about that film for about 25 minutes. Over like six comments.
So they brought it back briefly in theaters because it was such a meme, because everybody was dunking on it and just being like, this is so bad, that it was like trending on social media. So they thought like, oh, we should bring it back because it's really popular. And it lost them so much money again.
Oh my God.
It was so funny because they brought it back in theaters. They're like, you guys want this movie, right? You're making memes about it. And it just bombed again. And
it was a bad movie. It had terrible representation in it. And the acting in it was fucking atrocious. Well,
Jared Leto needs to stop.
He's another one that gives me a bit of the creeps. I don't know what it is, but it's just weird.
Well, he harasses his co-stars.
Well, and there you go. You see? My instincts. You see?
Yes, absolutely.
Never met the man. No, he's a weirdo. There was stories and reports of him on set, like using a wheelchair because he was method acting, making himself so weak that he could barely stand up. And you just think, mate, get over
somebody
yourself.
Just needs to just, push him can over. You just be like, just put him in the sea, go
force
away.
Force feed him bread or something and go and sit down with a Coca-Cola or something. But yeah, I was just like, disability is not like a fancy dress costume. You can't just go, okay, I'm going to try this for a week and see how it affects my character. Stop doing it. Just stop it. Get somebody who is disabled in to do it for you.
Well, and they still do that quite a bit. Well, I think it's less now, but I mean, for a long time too, they were doing that with the very few trans characters was, trans mass characters were basically non-existent. It was more of the trans misogyny of, and the violent trans misogyny of basically being like, oh, trans women are men in dresses, so we're just going to have these male actors, pretend to be a trans woman.
Yeah.
And it's really dangerous. It has a lot of like direct.
Eddie Redmayne.
Yep. And it has a lot of violent, harmful, direct impacts. And again, when you treat identities as a costume, right? Like it's not that it's just offensive. It's that it leads to directly harmful things, like all of the really transphobic legislation that we're dealing with on a lot of different levels, because that kind of violence becomes normalized within those stories. And so, yeah, again, it just goes back to, like, you can't just, you need these people writing the scripts and telling the stories themselves. Like, I just, there's just no other way around it, you know? So.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I agree with everything. Let's do that. That's that problem solved.
All right, great. Next. All right, what's next? Yeah, what do we do now?
Okay. That is manifesto number one.
Yeah. Leo, thank you. This has been it's so really interesting.
So good to have you on.
And thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. It's been great talking with you both.
We do a fabled series, mini series, where we talk about disability representation in film and TV
fiction
and all that kind of thing, and I think it'd be great to have you on like for a few episodes or an episode
to pick a film
or book or whatever. I think I see, look, our work here is done. Over to Leo for like 5 episodes a year. But I think it would be really, really useful to sort of have your input on it as well, if you wanted to be involved in any of those.
I mean, Lucy and I did I did a film degree, Lucy did a media degree, but that was 150 years ago because we're really old.
So
it would be nice to have somebody who's in it still, in the industry, and a bit more informed.
And you can tell us, what the hell are you talking about? Shut up. let me deal with this.
Okay. Team, I realise I did not, at the top of this episode, this is what happens when I let Lucy introduce the episode, did not say, this is all been part of our Pride series. All throughout June, we've been doing episodes for LGBTQ plus Pride Month, and it's been awesome.
Yeah.
And we've had so many awesome guests involved that we will be throwing other episodes that should have been recorded for Pride out throughout the rest of the year, but it's okay because we're just making sure that we're representing people all year round.
Yeah,
Pride is not just for June, guys.
You're telling me gay people exist outside of
June? I know, right?
They do.
Oh,
yeah.
God. What are we gonna do?
June is like the gay summer holiday.
I was going to say, it's like everybody gets a puppy for Christmas, and then by like mid-February, they're all in like shelters. That's what happens with gay people. Like by mid-August, you're all just back on the shelves.
Yeah, the corporations are like, wrap up the flag, guys. Okay, yeah.
Take down the rainbows down.
All right.
Leo, thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you guys for listening. Go back and listen to the other Pride episodes. Make sure you're subscribed to listen to the last one, which will be out next week. And we will see you next week, and then in every other episode after that. Because you'll love us and you'll never leave.
I'm not sucked yet. It's all right.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Label Podcast. If you like the show, you can rate, review and subscribe, and you can follow us on social media at Labeled Pod.
This episode was edited by Adam Hall. Our music was by Maisie Crunden, and we'd like to thank the rest of the team involved.